This volume differs in some ways from the first three volumes of your Years of Lyndon Johnson. All of them, I guess, have been about power. But this one takes us to sort of new heights of power from new depths of power for Johnson, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. Because when he's vice president, he's so powerless. He's despised by the Kennedy people. They have a nickname for him, Rufus Cornpone, or Uncle Rufus. They call him and Lady Bird, his wife, Uncle Rufus and his little pork chop. Then in an instant, in the crack of a gunshot in Dallas, he's elevated to be the most powerful man in the Western world.
That phrase, crack of a gunshot, I heard you say it in an interview on NewsHour with Gwen Ifill the other day. It is a powerful moment. It's something you just can't forget, isn't it?
Yes, and for Lyndon Johnson, you know, it's so dramatic. They're in Dallas. The motorcade is going through Dallas. It's a very low moment in Lyndon Johnson's life because he's beginning to wonder if Kennedy is going to even put him on the ticket again in 1964. There's a scandal unfolding in Washington at that very moment. A witness that's going to tie Johnson into the scandal, the Bobby Baker scandal, is testifying before Senate Rules Committee investigators. And Johnson is so doubtful of his political future that he's telling assistants to go find other jobs. He says to one, I'm finished. Go with someone else. Then there is the crack of the gunshot. The Secret Service agent in Johnson's car knows immediately that it's the crack of a hunting rifle. He sees President Kennedy a couple of two cars ahead, suddenly start to slump toward Jackie on his left. The agent wheels around, grabs Johnson by the shoulder, throws him on the floor of the car, jumps over the front of the back of the front seat, and throws himself on top of Johnson, and lies there as the cars start to speed toward a hospital. Johnson was to say, I'll never forget, his knees in my back and his elbows in my back. And as they get up to the hospital, the agent says to Johnson, when we get out of this car, don't stop to look at anything. We're going to get you into a secure place. So when the car stops, he's yanked out of the car by Secret Service agents, and he doesn't even have time to look at what's in the car next to him, which is President Kennedy's car, where he is still lying on the back of the front seat. The agents run Johnson through the corridors, looking for a secure room, and they finally put him in the back of a little cubicle in what's called the Parkland Hospital Minor Medical section. So for 40 minutes, Johnson is standing there against this wall. In front of him is his Secret Service agent, a man named Rufus Youngblood. In the room between that cubicle and the corridor are two other Secret Service agents. And at the door is a Secret Service agent with instructions not to let anyone past him unless he actually knows his face.
You know, this is such a vivid moment, and those of us who were alive at the time remember it as though it had just happened. But it also strikes me as you tell this story that parts of it are like a microcosm of Johnson's career. There's the moment when he's riding at the back of the parade, and then he's on the floor, which you could say is the lowest point of his career. But he is at that moment about to go forward.
Yes, you know, he's standing there for 40 minutes, Jim, and he can't get any information, any hard, definite information on President Kennedy's condition. He may, in fact, be president of the United States already, but he doesn't know it. He sends people out twice to try to get information, and the only word that they'll give him is that doctors are still working on the president. So he stands there against that back wall, and then after about 40 minutes, Ken O'Donnell, who was a Kennedy assistant who was very close to him, Lady Bird was to write in her diary that O'Donnell comes through the door, and she says, seeing the stricken face of Kenny O'Donnell who loved him, we knew. A moment later, another Kennedy aide comes in, walks up to Johnson, and says, Mr. President, and that's the first time he knows.
Wow. And everything changes. But really, before we can go on to talk about how everything changed, we can't ignore the Johnson of your first three volumes. He really was an extraordinary politician, right up to and including the moment when the convention came to be. He was the master of the Senate. How did he allow himself to get into the position of being vice president?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. In 1958, as you say, he's the Senate Majority Leader. He's called the second most powerful man in the country after only President Eisenhower. He is the most powerful and effective Senate leader in history. He's actually made the Senate work. The Senate before him was the same, believe it or not, the same mess it's in today. The Senate after him would be the same mess it's in today. But for the 6 years, 1955 through 1961, January 61, that he was majority leader, the Senate really worked. So he thinks in 1958 that he's going to have the Democratic nomination. He doesn't realize that this young senator, Jack Kennedy, is running around the country, brilliant politician, great speechmaker, rounding up delegates. Before Johnson realizes it, it's too late, and Kennedy has taken the nomination away from him. Then Kennedy offers him the vice presidency, and Johnson was to say, basically, if I was to oversimplify, that was his only chance to hope, you know, if you become vice president, you're no longer a sectional politician, you're a national figure, you're the natural leader for the president at the end of his 4 years or 8 years. And he calculates this, and he also calculates to tell you everything, because Johnson calculates everything. He actually has his staff people look up how many presidents have died in office.
Oh, my.
And it's the exact figure, but it comes out to one out of six. And someone asks him why he takes the vice presidency, and he actually says to them, he says to a lot of people the same thing, well, six of them didn't have to get elected.
Why, he's so smart. He does all this calculation. He looks into everything. He checks all the facts. Why did he so misunderstand JFK? He really didn't think much of the Kennedy brothers, did he?
He certainly doesn't think much of Jack Kennedy. And I think part of the reason is just that they came from such different backgrounds that he couldn't read Kennedy. I have a line in the book that Johnson, you know, as you know from my other books, he's a great reader of men. He's wonderful at understanding people's personalities.
That was part of his power, wasn't it? He could figure out what they wanted almost before they could.
Exactly. But I wrote in this book, The Passage of Power, this great reader of men, this man who thought he could read any man, had read one man wrong, and the man was Jack Kennedy. And I think a big part of the reason is that when Kennedy's in the Senate, he's young, he's still very sick, he's had these two horrible back operations where he's always in a pain, although he keeps smiling, no one really knows it, he's always in pain. And Johnson was to say about him as a senator, this is a quote from Lyndon Johnson, he was pathetic. He didn't even know how to address the chair. And Johnson sees this sickly young man, and that's what he calls him. He says he was sickly. He used to say, did you ever see his ankles? They're only so big around, and he'd hold up his fingers in a little circle. He actually said of Jack Kennedy, he's not a man's man. So he underestimates him completely.
On top of that, there's bad blood already with the other Kennedy brother, with Bobby, and I guess with their father as well.
Well, with Robert Kennedy, there's absolute hatred. These are two people who just can't stand each other in a chemical way. And there's a chemistry between them that's just from the first time they meet. It's horrible. And, of course, at the convention, after Jack Kennedy offers Lyndon Johnson the presidency, Robert Kennedy comes down three times to Johnson's room to try to persuade him to withdraw from the ticket. And Johnson was to hate him for that for the rest of his life.
Wow. Was there some particular incident, or is it just, as you say, chemistry?
Well, that's a good question. In some sense, there were incidents like trying to get him to withdraw from the ticket and others, but what you say is exactly right. There was a chemistry element involved. You know, the first time they meet is very telling because it's in the Senate cafeteria. Lyndon Johnson had breakfast in the Senate cafeteria, which was on the second floor of the Senate office building, every morning with some of his aides. And Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin had breakfast there every morning at the same time at a big table near the cashier's register with four or five of his aides. One morning, Johnson comes in, and there's a new aide at Joe McCarthy's table, and it's Robert Kennedy, then a 27-year-old, very slight, boyish-looking figure. And Johnson, you know, McCarthy jumps up, as all senators did, trying in deference to the leader, and his staff people all jump up. And McCarthy is saying, basically, you know, good morning, leader, wonderful job yesterday, Mr. Leader, anything I can do for you, leader. And Johnson shakes his hand in the hands of the staff members. But one McCarthy staff member doesn't get up, and he's Robert Kennedy, and it's deliberate. And Johnson walks over to him. Johnson knew how to handle this situation, any situation like this, and he sort of extends his hand halfway so that Robert Kennedy has to get up to take his hand. And one of Johnson's staff people who was with him said to me, I asked him why this happened. He said, did you ever see two dogs that didn't know each other come into a room and suddenly there's a low growl and the hair rises on the back of their necks? There was something between those two men that they just hated each other. All the time that Robert Kennedy is a staff member in the Senate, Johnson calls him, goes out of his way to call him Sonny Boy.
Well, that brings us back to the convention and why Robert went down three times to try to persuade Johnson to leave the ticket. But what he didn't know, I gather, was that John really wanted Johnson, not because he liked him, but because he needed him.
Well, he certainly did need him. You know, Lyndon Johnson does a great job of campaigning. He not only, people forget, President Eisenhower, not the Democrat, but President Eisenhower, the Republican, had carried Texas in 1952 and 1956. In 1956, he carried Texas by over 200,000 votes. No Democratic candidate is going to win for president in 1960 if he doesn't carry Texas. And to tell you the truth, he also, Eisenhower took five of the 11 southern states, and the Democratic candidate has to get some of these back. So Jack Kennedy basically goes down in the morning after his nomination, meets alone with Lyndon Johnson, and although there is not a firm understanding, both Johnson knows he's been offered it, and Kennedy believes he's going to take it. He comes back up to his suite, and there's a bunch of northern bosses there who can all count votes and know he has to have Texas, and he says it looks like he's going to take it. And they all shake his hand and congratulations. Now, the suites, the Kennedys are on the ninth floor of the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, and Johnson's suite is on the seventh floor of the hotel in Los Angeles. And there's a back stairs connecting the two suites, and three times that day, Robert Kennedy comes down to the Johnson suite to try to get Lyndon Johnson to withdraw from the ticket. Bobby Kennedy was to say that he did it with his brother's knowledge. He said, what do you think? We were so close. He says, what do you think? I would go down when my brother's asleep and get his vice president off the ticket. But in fact, it appears that Jack Kennedy truly wanted Johnson on the ticket, and Bobby's actions have an air of mystery about them.
There must have been days in the years to come, well, the year and some to come, when Lyndon Johnson wished he had pulled his name off the ticket and gone away, because they didn't let him do anything, did they?
No, the Kennedys cut him out of government pretty completely. You know, Johnson is the greatest legislator of the second half of the 20th century. He can get bills through Congress like no one else. Yet he once was to say that Kennedy's legislative aide, Lawrence O'Brien, he says in 2 years he never once asked me for a piece of advice. The Kennedys mock him, as you said before. They call him Rufus Cornpone. They insult him to his face sometimes. They won't call him Mr. Vice President, some of them. They keep calling him Lyndon, which he hates. And these are years of humiliation for him that are so painful that it's sort of sad to write about him.
And then the assassination and the return to Washington, and all of a sudden he has everything he'd ever wished for.
Yes, that's about sums it up.
What was his feeling that day? I mean, you hate to feel that he was elated about this, but I suppose in many ways he must have been.
Well, I certainly don't know that, Jim, and I don't say anything like that. What I really say is we can't know what Lyndon Johnson was feeling as he stood against the back wall in that cubicle for 40 minutes. No one will ever know that. What we do know is that when the Kennedy aide comes in and addresses him as Mr. President, letting that almost instantly he begins making decisions, hard and fast, and difficult decisions, making them with, you know, authority and decisiveness, that he's become in an instant a different man. You know, during the vice presidency, he lost so much weight that his suits, you know, bagged off him. He got new suits, they bagged off him. His face always had what they call a hangdog look. Even his steps, you know, as Senate Majority Leader, he strode around the Capitol with these long Texas strides. During the vice presidency, his stride is actually shorter. His shoulders are slumped. Now, as he stands there in these moments of crisis in the cubicle, the people around him, Lady Bird, a couple of Texas congressmen who are with him, they say he was transformed. You could, Lady Bird said it's like his face turned into a bronze graven image. His air of authority comes back, and the moment he has to start giving orders, he is back in charge.
There's that famous photograph of him taking the oath on Air Force One, and
yes,
there you do see Johnson back in form.
Well, you know, he knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted Jacqueline Kennedy beside him in the photograph as a symbol of continuity, that the Kennedy family bore him no ill will, of stability, one administration blending into the other, and he has her there. He has the photograph all arranged.
Yeah. Well, then he does get back, and he immediately goes into full LBJ mode, I guess. The thing that's surprising to me, in a way, is that he decided to put on a display of presidential power, and he'd used it to get civil rights legislation out of committee and enacted. Why do you think he chose that in particular?
Well, you know, Lyndon Johnson had always wanted to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. I write in this book something I went back to in volume one of the years of Lyndon Johnson. I write in the passage of power about how when he was only 20 years old, he's going to this little college in the midst of the hill country. He doesn't even have enough money for that. Johnson's very poor, has to drop out of college for a year. And during that year, he teaches school to earn money at a little town called Catula, which is below San Antonio on the way to the Rio Grande River. And he teaches in what's called the Mexican school there. And the children who he taught there recall how insistent he was that they learn English. He thought that was very important for them, how hard he tried to instill ambition in them. I wrote, no teacher had ever cared if these kids learned or not. This teacher cared. And I felt that you really knew that he really cared, Jim, because he didn't only teach the children, he taught the janitor. The janitor's name was Tomas Coronado, and he says that Johnson felt it was important for him to learn English, so Johnson bought him a textbook. And every day, before and after school, Johnson would sit with Coronado on the steps of the school with the textbook, and Coronado says, Johnson would spell, I would repeat. Johnson would pronounce, I would repeat. Now he's suddenly president, and he has to give his first speech to Congress after taking office from Kennedy. Kennedy's civil rights bill has been stalled in Congress. Congress has really stopped it completely. And the night before he has to give the speech, it's the, I forget, either the third or the fourth night after the assassination, a group of his speechwriters, as his advisors, are gathered around Johnson's kitchen table in his home. He still hasn't moved into the White House. And they are drafting the speech. And they're all saying to him, don't emphasize civil rights. Don't use up your political capital on civil rights. The Southerners control Congress. All you're going to do is alienate them and put your whole program in jeopardy. Don't use up your political capital. It's a noble cause, civil rights, but it's a lost cause. Don't fight for it. And you know what Johnson says? He says, well, what's the presidency for then? And in his speech, he says, I don't remember the exact words, the first and most important thing we have to do is to pass Jack Kennedy's civil rights bill. And when he says to one of his speechwriters later, in a later thing, he's about speaking of the kids in Cotulla. He says, you know, I swore then if I ever had the power to help those kids, I was going to do it. Now I have the power, and I'll tell you a secret, I mean to use it. Lyndon Johnson and civil rights is a thrilling story.
It is indeed. You know, what is also fascinating, though, and I think that it's probably true of everyone who reads your words now in the early part of the 21st century, is how he was able to get things done. He had been the master of the Senate. You call him the man who made the Senate work, the only one maybe in the 20th century. He came back as president, and he did it again. What can we learn? How did he do that? And is there any way, I mean, would you need another LBJ to be able to make that happen again?
Well, without going into to whether we would need another, I mean, just to watch what he does. I mean, if the passage of power, I don't say I succeeded in doing this, but what I tried to do in showing how Lyndon Johnson got Kennedy's civil rights bill and his other big bill, tax cut bill, which was vital to the country, showing how he got them passed, you really see political genius in action. You see a talent that's beyond a talent, a gift that's beyond a gift. He goes right to the heart of the situation. Kennedy's tax cut bill has been stalled in the Senate Finance Committee, whose chairman is Harry Byrd of Virginia. He's been chairman of the Senate Finance Committee forever. Johnson knew him very well in the Senate. So the Senate, Kennedy has introduced his bill back in January 11th, 1963. Now it's November 22nd. The bill is still in the Senate Finance Committee. It's not getting out of there. Harry Byrd is keeping it there. He's tied it in with Kennedy keeping his budget under $100 billion. The Kennedy people seem to think that the $100 billion figure is some sort of approximate figure. You know, Harry Byrd has said in his sweet, gentle, courtly Southern way, it would be nice if the budget came in under $100 billion. They seem to feel that that's just an approximation, that if they bring in the budget at $101.5 billion or $102 billion, that'll be fine with Harry Byrd. And they seem to feel that they can go around. They use the phrase, going around Harry Byrd. We'll go around Harry Byrd in the Finance Committee. On the second or third night after Kennedy's assassination, Johnson meets with Kennedy's three top economic advisors. They start talking about going around Harry Byrd. Johnson looks at them and basically says, you can't go around Harry Byrd. And they say, why not? He says, because there are 17 votes in the Finance Committee, and Harry Byrd always has 9 of them. And they say, how do you know Harry Byrd has 9 of them? And Lyndon Johnson looks at them and says, because Harry Bird always has nine of them. And all of a sudden, these advisors, they were to write memos on this. They say, all of a sudden, the problem is solved. It's all very clear. We have to give Harry Bird what he wants, bring it in under 100. And Johnson also says to them, he's not saying, although he's saying about 100 billion, he means under 100 billion. That's what he wants. It's a symbolic figure to him. And they say, all of a sudden, it was clear. We give Harry Bird what he wants. We bring it in $100 billion, and we can have the tax cut. That's a first place you have to have this knowledge of Congress. You have to know what's the weak, what is the one point you have to hit, and you have to know how to hit it. That's what I mean when I say, in seeing Lyndon Johnson, we see legislative genius in action.
You know, I was going to ask you how he persuaded the Kennedy men to stay with him, because many of them did. But I think you've just given us an example. They suddenly, perhaps, saw the mistake they made in not allowing him to use his skills when JFK was alive.
I think that's a big part of it. They suddenly saw him in action, and they realized he could get Kennedy's program through. Of course, he also... Johnson was a genius with men. You know, he says to each of these men, you must stay on. I need you more than he needed you, he being President Kennedy. Now, they would laugh. You know, when they got together, they would all laugh with each other. They would each say, he told me the same thing he told you. I need you more than he needed you. But what they don't realize is that this genius in dealing with men tailored that remark in each case to the specific individual. Like, one of the people he wants to stay on was Arthur Schlesinger, the great historian, and he who's working in the Kennedy White House. And he says to Schlesinger, you know, President Kennedy, knew history like you know history. I don't know history. I need you to stay on and help me with that. And to other, he tailors each remark to the person he's directing it to.
Wow. I wonder, for you, Robert Caro, what this volume means, because you have taken him from his low point to his high point, and you have another volume ahead, I understand.
Yes.
Are you sad at all that you've sort of hit his great moment now, when you have to now watch the fall?
Well, the last volume, of course, will have its great moments. You know, he passes the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, 60 separate education bills. It will have his great moments when he launches his great society. Of course, you're right. It's going to be a very darker book, because what is this? Those programs get swallowed up in the Vietnam War. I mean, his presidency, that's the way the presidency does not end in triumph.
No. Mr. Caro, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jim. My pleasure to be here.
Could you answer one more question for me?
Sure.
Just one. You have spent what for many people would be a lifetime on Johnson's lifetime. You know him perhaps as well as anyone this side of Lady Bird would. If you could choose, is there one day you would like to spend with him from all that you've studied?
What a good question. I've never been asked that. I think probably it's the day in 1965, Jim, when he gives his We Shall Overcome speech. You know, Martin Luther King is marching in Selma. It's a tough day for civil rights. I mean, that's the year where they're, you know, they have of the year of the police dogs, and the state troopers in Alabama with their truncheons, and the fire hoses turned on the black children. And Lyndon Johnson goes before Congress, and he says, we shall overcome, adopting the words of the black civil rights anthem, taking them as his own. We shall overcome. You know, Martin Luther King is listening to that speech in the living room of an aide in Selma. And when Johnson says that, we shall overcome, Martin Luther King starts to cry. It's the only time, his assistant says, that they ever saw Dr. King cry. I think that's probably the day I'd like to spend with Lyndon Johnson.
Thank you. I think you just made me cry.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much.